I want to start today by looking at a subject you may not have thought about a lot. The subject is, well, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 1:23. And we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greek foolishness. Today I want to talk to you about why Jesus was a stumbling block to the Jews. We want to look at the Jews' perception of what the Messiah was going to be like, and how Jesus differed from that, and why that caused them so much bother. But I also want to look at it from another aspect as well. I want to look at it of how we, as church, can become a stumbling block in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of fellow Christians, in the eyes of other people. How do we become stumbling blocks? So let's start off by, first of all, examining a few texts on what a stumbling block is. Now, in Leviticus 19 verse 14, you don't need to turn to this because I'm going to be reading them out of a wee sheet here. We have the first reference that I could find when I was doing my research on stumbling blocks, and it's this: you shall not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shall fear the Lord your God, for I am the Lord. Now this concept of putting a stumbling block before the blind, it sounds very mean, doesn't it? Because we understand exactly what has been said here. In other words, you don't put something in front of a blind person to trip over. And the reason you don't do that is because it would be mean. We understand that. We understand the concept. So the word for stumbling block here, what's being used here for stumbling block, is something that literally is causing you to trip up. And if you're going to trip up, there's a good possibility you're going to fall. But you know, there are times when perhaps stumbling blocks appear and have to be taken away. In Isaiah 57 verse 14, God here says, prepare the way, take the stumbling blocks out of the way of my people. In other words, what he's talking about here is when the people had been unable to find him, he himself, and we know who he was talking about, he's talking about Jesus, had to come and had to prepare the way so that they could understand and be able to accept God. So who had put the stumbling blocks in their way? What had caused them What had caused them so much bother that they were unable to come to God? The answer was the Pharisees. Why had the Pharisees done it? Because they hadn't taken the law and presented it as it really was. They had adjusted it to suit their particular needs and requirements. So when Jesus comes and he's teaching and he's guiding, one of the things we find in his ministry is that he's continually opposed to the religious leaders of his day. The laws of the Pharisees and the lawgivers and the scribes and the priests, these are learned individuals who took great pleasure in being able to sit at the best tables and literally lord it over the people because they were in a position of knowledge. So let's look at one of the first examples of how Christ started to become a stumbling block to them. If you're a Pharisee, you had to be taught all the rules and regulations of the law. You had to know them. Now, to be taught means you have to have a teacher. To have a teacher, and you want to be a good Pharisee, you need to get the best teacher that's available to you. Now, a lot of this is down to money. So if you were in a good family situation, and you had good prospects, let's say the best opportunity for improving your educational standards in regard to the law opens up to you. And the main reason for this is because The Pharisees, rabbis, the teachers of the law, chose their own disciples. It wasn't picked for them. They chose them. So, if you're a Pharisee and you're a rabbi, teacher, that aspect, and you're looking for disciples who you're going to teach and give them your understanding of the law and teach your way, the first thing you do is you look for the most suitable individuals possible, don't you? I mean, you want somebody that has respect in the community. You want people who come from good family backgrounds. And remember, to the Jewish mindset, where you come from is very, very important. So you pick the creme de la creme of what's available to you. You look for the rich, the powerful, those who will be able to take what you have and promote it on out. So as their name becomes popular, your name becomes even more popular, because who were you taught by? I was taught by William. I was taught by Jim. I was taught by anyone. Jesus didn't do it that way. Jesus decided to go for a walk by the seaside. Well, lakeside. You know what I mean. He saw some fishermen in the boat. Not creme de la creme, folks, honestly. In fact, when it comes to what the rabbis would have considered essential criteria, they don't even get into the list. They're not even there. These were uneducated men. And Jesus says, I'm going to call you to be my disciples. Come, follow me. So there's the first offense. The first rock of stumbling. Jesus is not working according to the rules. He refuses to work according to the rules. In fact, he's turning the rules upside down. He's just not getting on with the plan. As we go on through the scriptures, we find that Jesus starts to annoy them even more. He really becomes a thorn in the side to the Pharisees and to the Jewish teaching generally. He starts addressing problems which they didn't consider were problems. He says things like, for example, if you hit a man, it's the same as killing him. Any Pharisee will tell you, of course it's not. To kill a man means you take away his life. That's what the law says. If you actually cause that man not to be able to breathe permanently, that's killing him. Actually disliking him very strongly and wishing he would drop off the edge of a cliff, that's not killing him, so therefore that's not breaking the law. Jesus said, no, you've got it wrong. If you don't like him, if you really find this person an offense to you personally, and you wouldn't mind the fact if, you know, he fell under a number 9 bus, then it's the same as you going out and killing him. And that changed the whole remit of the law. It changed the whole rules relating to it. Because now you had to consider every aspect of it in a totally different way. You had to think of it from a spiritual standpoint. How it would affect your thought pattern. How it affected the law. And he didn't even stop there. He went on. He said, stealing. Now, Pharisees had never had a problem with stealing. They understood stealing right down to the nth degree. They said, we won't steal from God. We tithe on every last bit. But then Jesus said to them, yes, but hold on a second. God has all the silver, God has all the gold, God is rich, he doesn't need your money. But what he does expect from you, what he requires from you, is mercy, compassion, to show help and guidance to those less fortunate than yourself. To be able to go out and become a blessing to other people. That is giving. That is not withholding from God. Because when you don't do that, you're stealing. You're stealing a gift which God gave to the poor, you. Yeah. You're the gift God gives to the poor. I know. I find it amusing sometimes when I think of myself as a gift to the poor. I says, God, are you looking at my bank balance? But he says, I'm not interested in the money. I'm interested in how you interact with them, how you talk to them. And we're not just talking financially poor, we're talking spiritual poor, we're talking emotional poor, we're talking the whole aspect. You are a gift. And that's what Christ told us. And when he told the rabbis and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law this, they had mild coronaries. Because that would mean, for a start, they would have to think about the people. I mean, they would actually have to start considering the point that, you know, the people, those little ones down there, which we don't really have much to do with, we should be concerned about their welfare. Are you kidding? We don't have time for that. I'll just be happy enough paying my tithes. That'll keep me going. So Jesus was stirring up a hornet's nest, literally. He was making life very, very difficult for the religious establishment, because he's telling groups of academics what he thinks it should be. No. He's telling the grassroots people. He's telling the multitudes of people, this is how it's meant to be. And if it's not like this, it's wrong. Establishment don't like that. Establishment hate that. Here's a question. Do you think Jesus caused further problems? Oh yeah. Did he ever? There's a very simple law. It's to do with the Sabbath. We all understand it. It says you don't work on the Sabbath. Is that right? We're all aware of that. However, there is another law that says that a Jewish child, male, on the eighth day following his birth, has to be circumcised. This involves work. So, here's the problem. If it happens that the eighth day falls on the Sabbath, do you perform the physical work required for the circumcision, or do you wait a day? Jewish law indicated you don't wait a day. It is more important that you circumcise the child. And the Sabbath is therefore put to one side for that purpose. You don't have to worry about breaking the rules regarding the Sabbath in regard to circumcision. Of course, you do realize that that is quite a major little operation, and it requires a lot of aftercare afterwards. You have to care for the infant. You have to bathe the infant. You have to sterilize the wound. You have to, do a lot of work. And this care for the child is allowed. It's considered you are showing good to the child. And that's allowed in the Sabbath. You're allowed to do good in the Sabbath. This is the law. Rabbis, we have taught this all the time. You are allowed to do good on the Sabbath. So Jesus decided to put them to the test. There was a certain man. He had a withered hand. It was the Sabbath. Now, Jesus could have looked at this two ways. He could have. I mean, we even have a biblical definition of this, right? We could say in 1 Corinthians 8:9, where Paul is talking about our liberty, that we have to be careful as Christians not to allow our liberty to become a stumbling block to others. Right? We could say that Jesus could say, well, I have liberty, but I don't want to become a stumbling block. We could say Jesus could have said to the man, look, it's going to really upset the Pharisees if we go ahead and deal with your withered hand today. We could arrange for you to come back tomorrow, first in line, and we could sort it out then. I mean, Jesus could have done that. If he had have done that, he'd have been playing within the laws of the system, as the Pharisees saw. Jesus didn't like playing within the laws of the Pharisees. No, sorry. It wasn't going to happen. Jesus could even have said to the man, look, their objection here is the fact that it will be the Sabbath when you're actually healed. I can anoint you now, and then as soon as the sun sets, the healing will come. Jesus could have done that. That would have been a wee loophole. No, he could have argued with them, right? We're not actually doing the work, we're just making preparation for it. The work will not actually happen until after the Sabbath. He could have done that, but he didn't. He asked them a question. Is it right to do good on the Sabbath? And they couldn't answer. Not because they didn't know the answer, because as we said, they were very familiar with the answer. It is right to do good on the Sabbath. This individual was sick. He had a problem. It was a withered hand. Exactly how withered or how deformed this would have made the man or the difficulties this would have caused him, we really don't know because that detail's not there. But Jesus was highlighting a very important fact to the Pharisees. The Sabbath is for man. The Sabbath is for God. Blessing to be poured out on people who have need. The Sabbath is your opportunity during the week to reflect God fully. But you see, the Jews have got it the wrong way around. They said, no, the Sabbath is where we refuse to do anything. The Sabbath is where we keep ourselves away from sin as much as possible, and we don't even turn on, as in Israel today, an electric kettle, because that would be making the machinery work. The problem's still there. It still exists. But we as Christians have to remember that the Sabbath was given as a blessing, just as you are given as a blessing. So we can bless on it. But when Jesus healed the man, what was the attitude of the Jewish leaders of his day? Let's kill him. Let's get rid of him. This guy, we can't have him anymore. We got to get rid of him. What did he originally say about hitting someone? That you were planning murdering him? That you were actually breaking the commandments? So he was revealing all the time to them that they were not keeping the laws that they were teaching. Therefore, he coined a nice name for them. Do we all remember the name that Jesus coined for the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the teachers of the law? Hypocrites. In other words, you tell us what to do, but you don't do it yourself. We live in a world that looks at Christianity and calls us hypocrites. And it has very good reason for doing so, because it says, well, it says in your Bible, but I don't see it in your lives. And that's true. In many, many cases, what's in here isn't in here. It isn't in what we do every day. Are we sometimes becoming a stumbling block to the world through our actions, through the way we perceive things? Is there a danger that maybe we are becoming more like the Pharisees? That we are becoming more like the teachers of the law instead of more like Christ? Is Christ telling us from time to time to take stock of who we are and what we are? I think sometimes he is. Yesterday I was at a small Christian meeting. We had an evangelist about 4 weeks ago, came to Fintna. I know, Fintna, evangelist. This guy was from South Africa, name of Angus Buchan. Don't know if anyone has ever heard of him. He has a book out called Faith Like Potatoes. Very renowned evangelist. Fintna had, on the three nights that he ran, approximately 2,500 people attending. Now, any of you who know Fintna, the concept of 2,500 people appearing three nights in a row anywhere is, well, And this was for a religious conference. But they wanted to do a follow-up to that. So when they give, you know, the opportunity to stand up for Christ and make your commitment, they say, well, look, we're going to have, over the next three Fridays, we're going to actually have a wee Bible class, which you can come. And so they booked a hall and waited. 12 people came the first night. 10 people came the second night. And there was 8 last night. Their teaching was very simple. It was very basic. It was done by the Presbyterian Church, though it was not... In fact, I think the Presbyterian minister was the only Presbyterian there, if you see what I mean. Everybody else come from Baptist, Methodists. There was from Letterkenny, some group called... It's an evangelical group anyway, but I just can't remember its name. There was a lady in that. There was Catholics. There was no Church of Ireland. That was noted right across the board. They just didn't come. And there was one guy from the Vineyard in Dungannon. The Vineyard is that evangelical aspect in Dungannon works. That was it. So basically, they all were believers. They had come to a place that was teaching the fundamentals about Christ. And I was there too, guilty. My reason is I wanted to find out what was going on. I'm nosy. But I also wanted to see how they intended to push this forward. To take the evangelical aspect, which they had paid a lot of money into. Big money was put into that. And yet, there was no results. Not one new convert. I tell a lie. There was a new convert. I met him last night. His daughters run a Christian ministry in Coleraine. But he himself hadn't been a Christian. But he had decided to stand when the opportunity arrived, and he had come to the three nights. And I got chatting to him, we discussed, and this man had no knowledge whatsoever about anything. So, the information exploring Christianity, did that help him any? I'm not sure. I really don't know. Because he already knew a lot of what was being discussed. Did we grow any? No. But we had opportunity to talk afterwards, and you know what it's like. Give us the opportunity, we'll talk. And we did. So a little bit of evangelizing was done. And there will be fruit out of it. We know this. But did we cause offense? In some cases, I might have. Because I asked a question. And the question I asked was a very simple one. He kept saying, you die and you go to hell. You die and you go to hell. You die and you go to hell. And I said, as we're working out in Mark, would it not be better to point out that it's Gehenna, not the word hell, that's actually being used? And he said, oh yes, absolutely. And you want to tell them where Gehenna is? It was the rubbish dump outside Jerusalem. Okay. So when Jesus is talking about this, is he talking about their perception of hell, or is he talking about a rubbish dump outside Jerusalem? And the guy stopped talking. He wouldn't talk anymore to me. Well, he talked to me, but not on that subject. So I said, I'm not going to argue here, I'm not going to get disputing this, I am simply stepping back, and that was fine, there's no problem, we dealt with it. But the question is, why is there so much opportunity, shall we say, to be offensive and be a stumbling block to other Christians? Do we know stuff so radically different? No, they all know it. Is it because we want to believe what Christ says rather than call him a liar from time to time? Oh, and yes, people do call him a liar from time to time. We had one individual who came in, and he was, shall we say, he wanted to ask questions, and he asked some very doozy questions. He obviously wasn't coming from a Christian background. But you know, it was interesting how it was approached. His questions really were to the point. What happens when you die? The boy couldn't answer him. I'm sitting there going, can I speak? Can I speak? Can I tell him? No. I'm not there, I was down. Well, you, sir. Didn't get a chance to speak to this guy afterwards, by the way, because he was out of the door faster than a ferret. I mean, you never seen anybody leave a room so fast in your life. I turned. I think he felt he was outnumbered, outgunned, and he'd asked all the questions, and yet not one of them were answered. Not one of them. Which was, you know, a pity, because here was somebody actually asking questions. Offense. He obviously felt he either caused offense or he took offense at something that was being said to him. We do. We cause offense. But when we look at Jesus, we become aware of the fact that he not only became an offense, a stumbling block to the Jews, he occasionally manipulated the situation so that he would become that stumbling block. He put himself into a position to challenge what they felt was right because it didn't correspond with God. Sometimes we don't consider that that is part and parcel of being Christian. There are times when you have to literally trip someone up. You have to do that. And God does that. He talks about putting stumbling blocks in the way. Especially if people are going off in their own little world, heading off into their own belief structure. God occasionally will stick a stumbling block in the way. Something to bring them down. Not necessarily to destroy them, but simply to get them to question what's going on. We read about this as well. In Ezekiel 7 verse 19, the individuals being described here have a major problem with riches, silver and gold. And in Ezekiel, we are told they will throw their silver into the street, their gold will be refuge. The silver and their gold will not be able to save them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. They will not satisfy their soul, nor save, nor fill their stomachs, because it is their stumbling blocks of iniquity. The silver and the gold became their stumbling blocks. Not religious teaching in this case. And that's common. I mean, how many people do you know that you could honestly say God's their money? Success, power, prestige. That's all they're actually interested in. And everything they do is towards that goal. You see, that's a stumbling block, because that's stopping them being able to step out and follow God. It stops them actually being effective. Now, it's not a stumbling block if they know nothing about God. You know, if God has never actually put a call in their life, it's not a problem, because that's all they have. But when it stands between you and God, it's a stumbling block. Jesus highlighted this with the story of the rich young ruler. We're all familiar with the story. This man wanted to please God. This man knew the law inside out. This man gave to the poor, helped people, and did all the rest of the right things that he needed to do. He honored his parents. He was perfect. Till Jesus threw a stumbling block in his way. Something he couldn't get his head around. Something that just stopped him in his tracks. There's only one thing you need to do. Go and sell everything, give it to the poor, and come and follow me. Couldn't do that. That's the stumbling block. Set right in the middle of the path. In other words, this is the problem that we need to address. The stumbling block. In his case, it was riches. We're warned to be very careful, though, when it comes to this. In Romans 14, verse 13, we're told not to judge anyone. And the reason we're told not to judge anyone is so that we do not create stumbling blocks that will cause them to fall. And we as people have a very bad habit of judging. When I was growing up, there was no school uniforms at school, if you appreciate what I mean. When I went to primary, we didn't have a school uniform system. So people came in whatever clothes, basically, they were fit into. But we lived in an area that had some people who were very well off and some people who didn't quite meet that criteria. And you could tell the difference by their clothes. But the teachers inevitably made a judgment on appearance. And they would separate the children to a degree on dress. And you could tell us about somebody to look. If you went to the front of the class, you could actually see. On this side of the room is all the well-dressed, well-shod families. On this, these are the rest. This side, the teacher would talk to. She would discuss what. She would tell them. She would go down that side and she would go carefully working with them and all the rest. This side, whatever, you know, forget it. Now, you might say, well, that sounds terrible. But that is a normal reaction that people have when they look at people. They make an assumption. They make a judgment. They say, this is what we're like. Do we agree with these people? Do we agree with those people? Are we more in this camp or more in that camp? And, you know, we're judging us all the time. The Corinthian church did that. Remember Paul's letter to the Corinthians? One of their biggest difficulties that they had was when they went to meet together as a fellowship and share the Passover meal, or the Lord's Supper, depending which way you want to look at this. They actually had a big meal. They ate. So it was really a Passover meal, if you like. But those who were rich ate well. And those who didn't have any money didn't. Sometimes they didn't eat at all. They went hungry. There was problems, difficulties. There was judgments being made. And Paul had to tell them off rather strictly that, you know, you have got it wrong, guys. There should be no difference between you. He who is rich should be paying for he who is poor, and he who is poor should be working with he who is rich as an equal. Literally, as an equal. If somebody comes into your fellowship, they shouldn't be able to tell who is what, where, and when, because you are all supposed to be working as one family. I mean, you don't see a family where you have five or six children, and one's a ragabond, and all the rest are dressed up to the 99s, because, well, we can't afford to feed that one or clothe that one. I mean, that doesn't happen, does it? That's not a judgment that you would see in an ordinary family home. But it's a judgment you see in the world. It's a judgment you see in many churches. It's a problem. It's a difficulty. Stumbling blocks. Stumbling blocks. Christ was a stumbling block. And we, at times, can be stumbling blocks too. Sometimes we have to be. As I said, we have to be simply because there's a correction to make. A change of position. Sometimes, however, we shouldn't be. And when it comes to judging others and making arbitrary decisions about them, we should stop in our tracks and say, hold on a minute. That individual is equally as much a child of God as I am. My Father in heaven gave Jesus Christ for him as much as he gave him for me. And if we could get that in our minds, if we could start seeing that as the reality, then our judgments would become less. We would judge less. But that'll take time. That'll take the Spirit of God working in us. And that'll, you know, something we're working on. Something we're always working on. Now, I'm not saying anything about anyone here. I don't know yourself well enough. I'm not even saying anything about anyone in Craig Evan, because while I attend there on a regular basis, I don't know them well enough. I'm speaking to myself. And I'll tell you why I'm speaking to myself. Opportunities arrived to me on a day-to-day basis where I could help people to do different things. But it's sometimes inconvenient. Sometimes it's hard. Anyway, they wouldn't really want me to speak to them or talk to them. You know, I'm not a guy that lives down the road, belongs to that funny religion. You know what I mean? They're quite happy if I give them a wide berth. And then, I have to be honest, sometimes I prefer giving them the wide berth. But my problem is, when I'm looking at what Jesus was doing, I find that he purposely went and talked to these individuals, even if it did antagonize them, even if it did annoy them, even if it was being a stumbling block to them at times. He told them the truth. He came, he wrote with them, he talked to them, he ate with them, he did everything. He didn't say, I'm only going to go to the poor. He also went to the rich. He didn't say, I'm only going to deal with the sinners. He also dealt with the righteous. He was equal with everyone at every step of the way. And I'm not. But I got to start learning to be. Because that's what this is telling me. The biggest stumbling block on my progress as a Christian is standing up here speaking. It's me. I've got to learn to look at people and see them as Jesus Christ saw them. And where there is inconsistencies with God's word, I have to correct. And where there is lack of knowledge, I have to teach. And where there is an opportunity to help them physically, emotionally, spiritually, and it's within my gift to do it, it's my responsibility. And I would say, it's all our responsibilities. Because that's how we are. That's what we're meant to be. We've looked at stumbling blocks. We didn't look at the foolishness, which is the other side of that quote that I started with in First Corinthians 1, verse 23. I didn't look at foolishness. But we all know that the other side of it is that to the Gentiles, to the Greeks, our way of life, our way of looking at things, and all that we stand for is totally foolish. But I think we have enough trouble overcoming stumbling blocks.